Good day and welcome to this Prevent Connect web conference. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to your host, Mr. David Lee. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much and welcome everyone today to our web conference, Masculinity, Sex, and Hip Hop. And I'm really pleased to have you be able to join us for this really exciting conversation that we will be all having together. I want to just familiarize you with Prevent Connect and that we are an online community of people who are engaged in the prevention of domestic violence and sexual assault, and that we have our web conferences, and I encourage you to join us on other web conferences. We'll be announcing our web conference series very soon. We have an exciting year. We also have reading clubs where we take small articles and have small web conferences to discuss those and be able to get a chance to be able to share with each other. We have also our Prevent Connect Wiki, where we users create information about prevention of violence against women. We have a wide range of podcasts and e-learning units, so go check it out on our website, preventconnect.org. I hope you can follow us on Twitter at Prevent Connect, and we also now are blogging. Those of us at Prevent Connect are doing a lot of blogs, so it's a chance to be able to share and get ideas, and you can catch us at calcasa.org. We are also become our friend on Facebook, and we also do have our email group, or what is commonly known as a listserv, and make sure you sign up. You'll be getting our newsletters announcing our conferences. I am David Lee, and that's I'm here working with Chad Smith, who is actually raising on a different computer, so in a different room. Just we looked across the hall to be able to see there. If you have any questions, you know how to be able to contact us there. I just want to talk a little bit about how to use this technology, and we have several different pieces. The first thing we want to do is have people learn to raise your hand. The way you raise your hand is very simple. What you do is you click on the hand that appears just a little bit above my head on the top bar. It's sort of here. I'm drawing a circle where that hand would be. So everyone raise their hand. I see that many of you have raised your hands. I've got 40, 50 of you have raised your hands, so keep on raising your hands. Raising the hand is a feature that we might be asking questions later on. It will also give us a chance for you to be able to ask questions, being able to raise the hands. I'm going to lower everyone's hands right now, but this is a way that when you have questions later on, you'll be doing it. I see people are still raising their hands. Great. We also have our questions and answers, and we can learn a little bit more about who our audience is. And so I want to be able to get a sense of who you are. So what I'm going to do is open up some questions. And the first question I want to know is if you have attended a web conference before. Click the first one if this is the first web conference you've ever attended. B, if you've attended web conferences before, but this is your first Prevent Connect web conference. And C, if you've attended Prevent Connect web conferences before. So I want to get a sense of how many people. I see that about 75% of you have voted, so there's still another 25% of you who have not voted yet. So go ahead, and I saw someone wrote B in the text chat. Go ahead, just click on the screen and do that. I'm going to share the results with you just so you can see who's in our audience. And it's great to see that we have 6% of you. This is your first web conference, so welcome. I hope you really enjoy the chance to be able to interact with each other that we have on our web conferences. We also have 31% of you have attended web conferences before, but this is your first one at Prevent Connect. So welcome to Prevention Connection. We have a series of a wide range of web conferences. And then a full 48% of you have attended many before, and that means there's another 10% of you who didn't vote. Now I want to know learn a little bit about who's in the audience. So I want you to be able to list which one is the best way to describe your organization. Are you a sexual assault prevention or rape crisis center, a domestic violence prevention or battered women's shelter, a dual domestic violence or sexual assault agency, a sexual assault or domestic violence coalition? Are you with the public health department? Are you with education, K through 12, or education with a college or university? And I've seen quite a few people from colleges and universities here. Or are you with the criminal justice system or legal system or other? I have a lot of categories. Let's see who's voting. Great. I'm getting some of our votes in, and I'm going to share the results with you all now so you can get a sense of who's out there. We have 11% are with sexual assault prevention or rape crisis centers, 6% in domestic violence or battered women's shelters, 28% of you are dual, both domestic violence and sexual assault. We've got several people from coalitions, public health departments, and a lot of you from colleges and universities. So that's great. And 9% of you said you were other. So if you're so what I'm going to do is I'm going to close this poll right now and close the window, and you will be all of you will now see back to our screen here. If you could write your text chat, if you wrote other, can you write down what you are? And April asked, what's dual mean? Dual means both a sexual assault and domestic violence agency. And then in many communities throughout the country, we have both. So if you could write down who you're both. So we got someone from, we have Sarah from CDC. Great to see you, Sarah. And we've got some, someone, and someone's checking their spelling. And we've got a filmmaker here. That's great, Nancy. And we've got someone from the Department of Social Services. And we've got a few other programs here. Reproductive Health Think Tank, that's really great. Family Planning Coordinating Council, and another nonprofit. So thank you so much for sharing that. We do have PowerPoint slides that you are seeing on the screen. If you want to get copies of the slides, just go to preventconnect.org, and you can download them. We have those available for you. We also have, if you have any other questions, you can always send a private text chat to us. And the way that you send text chats, for those of you, most of you who have figured it out, is you just go ahead and write a little message here and then click on this box here, and then we get to see the message. If you want to make it easier to read, because we've got right now 157 people, and I'm expecting to get more as the day goes on, and want to expand it, you can do what's called undock. And if you look in the upper right-hand corner of your chat, sort of drawing a little box there, click on that upper right-hand corner box. That will make the chat box a little bigger and easier to read. And so you can always click that same button to make it smaller. We will be talking about violence against women here today and in Prevent Connect. And when we talk about it, we're talking about domestic violence and sexual violence. We are looking at violence across the lifespan. And what we want to do at Prevent Connect is to really focus how we can prevent before violence starts in the first place. And we want to be able to make connections to other forms of violence and other issues. Prevent Connect is a national project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, sponsored by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views and information provided in this web conference do not necessarily represent the official views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. So I think I have done my disclaimer aside, and welcome everyone here today for our today's session on masculinity, sex, and hip-hop. And I do want to give credit today. The reason we came to do this is that our speakers today, Shira Tarrant and Byron Hurt, were doing a reading over at Bus Boys and Poets over in Washington, D.C., and Chad and I at Prevent Connect were having a conversation. I said, wow, that would be great to see it. And he said, why don't we ask them if they'll do it as a web conference? And he got on various internet forms of communication to be able to contact Shira and Byron, and they're able to join us today. So thank you, Chad, for the idea, and thank you, Shira and Byron, for joining us today. So I'm going to introduce both of them. I'm going to start with Shira. Hi, Shira.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And so Shira is the author of the book Men and Feminism, When Sex Becomes Gender, and also has a book coming soon called Pleasure and Peril, Questions About Sex in Bed and Beyond. When is that going to be coming out, Shira?
I don't have a date. I will let you all know, though. I'll be happy to let you know.
Okay, it'll be coming soon. She's also the editor of Men Speak Out, Voices on Gender, Sex, and Power, which Byron contributed to, and also coming in 2011, Fashion Talks, The Undressing, The Power of Style. And she's also a writer for a wide variety of magazines and blogs, and you can see her blog, the address there. And I guess your day job is you're also a professor over at the California State University in Long Beach. You're in California.
Yeah, that's
so,
right.
So much for joining us.
Thank you.
And I'm going to introduce our other speaker is Byron Hurt. So hi, Byron.
What's up, David? How you doing, man?
Doing great. Great to be able to talk to you. And for those of you who are not familiar with Byron, Byron is an award-winning documentary filmmaker. He's made a wide variety of pieces. Many of us in this work are very familiar with hip-hop, Beyond Beats and Rhymes. He's also put together I Am a Man, Black Masculinity in America, and also Barak and Curtis, Manhood, Power, and Respect. And right now is working on Soul Food Junkies. And so if you want to get information, you help support him in building that, in being able to create that film, you'll see a link on the page. So you can do that. He's also done a lot of work around gender violence prevention educator, working with MVP and doing work with the Marines, and has had the opportunity to speak throughout the country. I think I've seen Byron at many meetings in the last few months. And we've and also as a writer with many other places. So welcome to join us on today's webinar.
Thank you.
Well, great. Well, what we're going to do today is have a conversation, and we're going to be highlighting on some reading, some writings that both Shira and Byron have done. And so we're going to start by having Shira share a little bit of writing that she did in her book Men on Feminism. We'll be asking you, the audience, to be able to do some brainstorming to around some questions, and then we'll be, and then Shira and Byron can be able to comment on that, and then Byron will be sharing an essay that he wrote, excerpts of an essay that he wrote, and we'll be also posing questions to you, and then we'll open it up to questions. Anytime you have a question, go ahead and be able to write in your questions in the text chat, and we'll be able to do this. And so I already see people are talking about Beyond Beats and Rhymes. Someone says it's amazing, and someone's ready to buy a book right now at Amazon. So I guess we are helping sales just as we speak. So that's how we'll be structuring it. It's going to be a conversation. And so that's our goal, is to be able to have that conversation. Oh, and thank you for remembering to change my piece. So we're going to start with Shira, and Shira's going to do a reading from her book, Men and Feminism. And so we're going to start, though, with a text chat question. And so the question that we want to be able to ask all of you is, what does masculinity mean to you? And so if you can write in a text chat, it means to you, and I'm going to write that in the text chat also right now for you all, and let's talk about what this means. So what I see is confidence, stereotypical male roles, white men in power, strength used to serve toughness, characteristics of strength, men being comfortable in their bodies, provider, butch, associated with men, white men in power, privilege, checking privilege, being tough. I see a lot of toughness. Well, here's an interesting one from Wendy. The opposite and complement of femininity. Policing by other men. So this is really, and Ashley has an interesting comment, trying to define it in a positive way and having difficulty. So a lot about strength, no emotions expressed. poor privilege provider from Kelly. Thank you, Kelly. And so we see Tara talks about a social construction, and Kelly comes right back with a social construct. And so we see a lot of this. So, Shira, we can see a lot of what our audience is thinking about what it means.
Mm-hmm.
So why? Okay. Yeah, well, let's – I think that your first – your readings are going to be talking about your impressions of looking at that. So let's start with you doing a little bit of reading from your book, Men and Feminism.
Okay, thanks so much. This is real. This really is interesting to see where people are at to get a snapshot of perceptions about the word masculinity. And before I jump in with the reading, I just want to say two quick things that I'm going to be reading about masculinity, about pornography, about men getting involved with violence and sexual assault prevention, how we can rethink masculinity. But I'm hoping we can also talk both about minimizing or preventing harm and also talk about maximizing our freedoms and our sexual pleasures. And the second thing I want to mention just really briefly is that I'm not framing these issues or these concerns as moral issues but as political issues. So, in other words, my focus is on issues of constraint and freedom, control and safety, power and pleasure, not whether somebody's good or bad and that kind of moral thing. So, The first section that I want to read from is from the beginning of the book, and it's it starts on page 19. Americans like to brag how we're the freest country on earth, yet half of us don't even feel free enough to walk by ourselves at night. Many women aren't even safe in their own homes. By conservative estimates, 20% of adolescent girls have been physically or sexually assaulted by a dating partner. Two-thirds of American men, responding to a major American public opinion poll in 2000, said that domestic violence is very or fairly common. And 92% of people who answered a 2005 national survey said that family violence is a much bigger problem than people think. And these issues are not unique to the United States. As Jackson Katz points out, it's a mistake to think of sexual assault or domestic violence as, quote, women's issues. Men's violence against women is really more about men than it is about women, Katz explains in The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. What he means is that because men are the ones committing the vast majority of violence, it's time for men to face up and do something about it. We live our lives in relation to other people, Katz notes. Something that affects women no doubt affects men, and vice versa. As I explore in more detail later in this book, when it comes to issues such as pay inequity or male violence toward women, there's a tremendous amount of work that men can do to stop the problem before it even happens. Prevention is the real solution. The most important thing is that we talk with each other as we continue coalition building between women and men and across the political spectrum.
Well, I thank you, Cheryl. I think this really raises interesting questions. Let's pose a question to the audience, actually, as the next text chat. Just to do this, let's think about the relationship of what this has to do with feminism and masculinity. Because you raised the question how it's not a women's issue, and let's see what people have to say. Compliments. Brian talks about feminism, it liberates it. Feminism is a men's issue for Melanie. Mainstream society feels feminism is too radical. Should complement, Joe says. Feminism is a positive response to a negatively formed ideas of masculinity. Feminism attempts to deconstruct masculinity. Target versus non-target identities. So it's very interesting to see how I'm noticing a theme here that feminism can embrace masculinity, and then also someone says feminism challenges masculinity, and maybe that's specifically. And Jordy says that masculine men aren't supposed to be feminist according to society. What are some of your thoughts about this, Shira?
I'm sorry, you cut out for 1 second. Could you repeat that?
Just can you share your thoughts of what you're seeing in the text chat?
Well, it's fascinating to me to get really this wide variety of responses. I mean, one thing, you know, if we think that masculine is, you know, that men are too masculine for feminism, then we're presuming that masculinity means something and masculinity and feminism are mutually exclusive. So this is really fascinating to me, and I talk a lot in Men and Feminism, obviously that's the name of the book. I talk a lot about why men don't need to shy away from feminism, and also how it's problematic to assume that feminism is something that only women do, because feminism is looking at some of the social problems in our society and we're looking at it through a gendered lens, right? So if we think that it's only about women and it's only women's job to fix it, it's like saying, clean up the dirty work of society, ladies, you know? So that's a kind of curious position. And also feminism questions gender essentialism, you know, tying a male body to a certain idea of masculinity or a female body to a certain idea about femininity. So, you know, we need to start breaking down those ideas in order to then really get at issues of sexual violence and domestic violence more effectively.
I see an old debate. Brian raises men being feminist or pro-feminists.
That's a great question. You know, my thought about that is I don't think that we need to get bogged down in the title. I mean, some people are really freaked out by the word feminism. Some people prefer womanist, which is not a subset of feminism. Some men prefer to say feminist or feminist. And I think at the end of the day, I think it's the work that matters. It's not that we can't be concerned about what we're calling ourselves, because that's a political issue too. But I think at the end of the day, it's, you know, what kind of work are we doing? But I think it's a great question. So thank you, Brian.
Okay, and there's some. This is great. So I actually, let's go on to the next reading. But this is great. Keep on coming in, being able to do this. Though Ashley makes a very interesting comment as we think about, as we'll move later in our conversation, work in men in feminism and men in sexual violence prevention have often been separated, yet I think so much of the work of sexual violence prevention has been so greatly informed by feminism that we really need to be able to pay attention to those lessons.
Yeah, yeah. So, David, are we ready for the next section then?
To the next section.
Okay. So this section starts on page 94, and the subheading is, hey, what's in that guy's knapsack? And those of you who are familiar with Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack, it's drawing off of that. And it's about men, masculinity, and privilege, and I saw the issue of privilege come up in some of the comments. One of the crucial issues we need to talk about is men, masculinity, and privilege. Masculine privilege lends men access to power, which has a serious impact on gender equality. Some forms of injustice, such as sexual assault or pay inequity, are obvious and concrete. Other instances of bias are damaging precisely because they're so hard to pinpoint. Masculine privilege is buttressed by a sexism that runs so deep through our collective psyches that it's practically invisible. When little boys are encouraged to be more active or allowed to get dirtier than girls when they play, there is subtle yet profound gender construction at hand in which boys learn to exercise a greater range of motion and physicality. Most pronouns used for God are masculine, his, him, father, and most visual images for God are male. The pronoun guys may, without question, refer to a group of both men and women, but referring to that same group as girls is an unacceptable alternative. Men can walk relatively freely through the world without fear of sexual harassment and rape unless they are young boys, are gay, are incarcerated, or visibly deviate from gender norms. Men can assume people will listen when they talk, and they don't generally struggle to make their voices heard, although this may not necessarily be true in a mixed-race group of men. Men don't usually have to worry that if they are aggressive or opinionated, they will be condemned or called a bitch. Men can take for granted that they're the norm, the standard bearers. Guys, especially straight, white, able-bodied guys, can be pretty sure that when they see the front page of the newspaper, flip through the sports section, or meet their tenured physics professor, the faces they see will look a lot like their own. And when those faces don't, as when the doctor, dentist, or plumber turns out to be a woman, it might be a big surprise. The fact that people still specify female doctor but don't spell out male doctor is evidence that a male norm is still in play. Books, magazines, college campuses, and television shows still tend to make universal assumptions that words such as mankind, chairman, policeman, or freshman refer to everyone. What we think of as regular or neutral is often based on the assumption of a male standard. For most professional sports teams, the men's league is the presumed norm and the women's is the exception. The NBA is men's basketball, but women's pro ball is singled out as the WNBA. Colors are thought of as gender neutral, such as blue and green are associated with boys. Clothing that is thought of as gender neutral is associated with men, pants, slacks, suits, etc., not women, skirts, stockings, dresses, etc. Masculine privilege means guys can turn on the radio or watch music videos knowing it's unlikely they will encounter lyrics or visual images that refer to them in sexually degrading or objectifying ways. And that's where that section ends.
It's really interesting, and I'm seeing the comments talking about the power. And let's actually think about this related to another text chat question I'm going to pose to the audience. And let's think about how does violence relate to masculinity, and how do you, in your work that you do in your community, see violence related to masculinity? So let's take a couple minutes to do that in the text chat, and I know we're going to see a lot of writing here. So someone talks about they have to prove their masculinity or their feminism. Power and control, they go hand in hand. They've been conflated. And so I see a lot of relationship about proving masculinity Dane has an interesting comment. She talks about it's a misperception of what masculinity is. Yet Nancy talks about, uses the expression, boys will be boys, the excuse that we often see. And then, once again, the entitlement issues that you talk about.
I think Barb's point is really important, too.
That speaking out against violence is equal to being anti-male. So there's an expression, traitors to their cause.
Mm-hmm.
And so that that's a really interesting one. And then Michelle raises an important issue about the socialization of men in, that you talk about in the writing, and that it starts, I'm amazed how quickly it starts, the socialization of men, from instant upon birth.
Mm-hmm.
I had to fight for a pink hat for my son in the hospital for not wanting to do it. And there we buy our dolls for the girls and guns for the boys. And if you don't, there's something that's seen wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I did. We did get the pink hat. So we. I wasn't going to give up that battle. So great. So we. Emily talks about we can't have a conversation about interpersonal violence without discussing the perpetration of wars on a macro level historically by men. And that's a really important point of looking at that the resolution of that violence is not just something that happens within our own relationships, but happens throughout the sectors of where men work.
Yeah, and if I could jump in on that, I think that's such an important point too, because I'm a political scientist, and so from the lens that I use to understand these issues from a political perspective, a really effective way to control a group of people is through either actual violence or through the perpetual threat of violence. And so whether we're talking about war or street violence or interpersonal violence, they're all linked, I think, in a very important way with this issue of controlling a group of people. And to say that out loud is to risk being called a man-hater, when actually what it is really to risk having difficult conversations, I think.
Okay, and then I've seen several people make comments of looking at how violence is a tool of oppression, and that
mm-hmm.
and I even saw a fist pump response to comments. And this has come up several times, and I think that we really do need to look at the intersection of race, ethnicity, and class, and how that interfaces that, because gender is not the only lens where privilege and violence intersect.
Absolutely.
And I think that particularly as Byron starts looking at the issues of hip-hop and masculinity, which is primarily looking at, you know, often the masculinity of men of color, then is a discussion that we'll have to do that. And, I'm even seeing a reference to Chuck D. So from Jessica about that. Well, why don't we talk about one more section, and then we will be able to look at that. So this is really a great discussion, and we're going to continue this discussion. Move on a little bit further. So what's the next, I think it's the last section that you're going to read, Shira.
All righty. There's so many sections I could go through. The last section that I will read from is about pornography and privilege, which puts a lot of issues on the table. And pornography is related to pop culture issues. So pornography and privilege, this starts on page 102. Some people argue that pornography is another way masculine privilege is constructed and reinforced. It's true that pornography certainly highlights women's sexual bodies, but porn doesn't focus only on women. Not all pornography is straight or heteronormative, but a lot of it is. And men aren't the only ones looking. Women watch porn too. So how can we know that pornography reinforces male privilege? The vast majority of pornography depicts sex acts being done to women, women being on display for the pleasure of others, women depicted as deriving pleasure primarily by pleasing others. This is not a moral issue, it's a political one. Sex and pleasure are great. Some political theorists, such as Herbert Marcuse, even argue that sexual pleasure is a form of political liberation. But what consenting adults enjoy sexually and what they do with their bodies is their personal choice. But in mainstream porn, the viewer is usually assumed to be male. Cruelty or degradation of women plays a central role, and women's bodies exist mostly for men's pleasure. To be blunt, given that face shots, gangbangs, gonzo, and airtight scenes are stock material, we need to start asking some real questions about gender politics and mainstream pornography. The point is not to ban porn or to demonize people who make it or who like to watch it, but to understand how porn functions in propping up masculine privilege and influencing our cultural narratives about sexuality. We live in a culture that is infused with pornographic imagery. Porn and sex work have become models emulated by so much of mainstream life. For example, pole dancing fitness classes, easy internet access to porn, porn peddling banner ads and email spam, porn-infused music videos, and G-strings with cherries and the words eye candy marketed to tween girls. With the mainstreaming of pornography melded onto a culture with pre-existing gender disparities, we tend to end up with a narrow version of sexual pleasure. Because pornography has a wider reach than it used to, it is fast becoming the primary way that people learn about sexuality and pleasure. Yet in porn, we see the same sexual tropes repeated over and over. This gives the misguided impression that pornography provides visions of sexual diversity when it actually offers lots of opportunities to see the same thing. It's like fast food. Coast-to-coast drive-thrus offer lots of chances to get the same hamburger and fries. They don't offer a lot of options in choosing what to eat. But arguing that porn is just fantasy, which some people do, is like saying advertising has no effect on our buying habits, or that news media have no impact on how we understand current events. How could it be true that every other form of mass media has an impact on our habits and collective consciousness, but that porn is just fantasy? And even if porn is just fantasy, then what do these fantasies reveal about the ways in which gender and masculinity are constructed and about how privilege is reinforced and maintained? And what are the consequences of these common cultural tropes? One study of campus-based sexual assault found that men were sexual aggressors toward more than half of women, college women interviewed. 47% of men who had committed an act that met the legal definition of rape said they expected to engage in a similar assault in the future. 88% of men who reported having committed an assault that met the legal definition of rape were adamant that they had not committed rape. Meanwhile, only 27% of women who experienced assaults that met the legal definition of rape labeled themselves as rape victims or survivors. We live in a culture in which the sex domination nexus is so tight that victim and victimizer alike often do not recognize the violence and acts that the society has deemed violent enough to be illegal. According to Robert Jensen, the inability to recognize sexual assault for either perpetrator or survivor is at the core of what's called a rape culture, and it's propped up by mainstream pornography. So I'll end there, which I'm sure leaves lots of food for thought and discussion.
It certainly does. Let's follow this up with a little text chat that we can think about. As Nancy said, a really thorny issue, but I think an important issue that we have to be able to talk about. So the question that we want to pose is, here's more pages. How do you see the relationship between pornography and masculinity? And we might be drawing it in as the reading did, to looking at the relationship to pornography, sexuality, and sexual assault. And Jody uses the term, real men like porn. And then Tara talks about the eroticization of power. And then Ashley, that's what the industry tries to create, that relationship. So interesting to see this, Shira, as people talk about media-fueled men. Men are usually in control in mainstream porn. I think an interesting piece is now people are writing quickly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Joe talks about porn propaganda for hyper-masculinity. A false, Stephanie talks about a false boosting of masculinity. And then there's the demeaning of women and then the eroticization of dominance. Ashley posted the question about sex-positive feminism.
Yeah, that's so I'm trying to type fast. I think one of the things that's so crucial, and this is where my work is moving into, is how we can talk about sex-positive sexuality and anti-sexism in the same sentence so that we're, you know, so that we're grappling with both at the same time.
I think from a prevention standpoint, that's so important because what we're trying to do in our work of primary prevention is to be able to not just talk about what we want people not to do, but to really be promoting what we want to see. And that health promotion approach, as would be said in the public health world, is an important piece that we have to include in our violence prevention efforts.
Yeah, I agree. And health promotion means real sexual diversity, because what we're being told is sexually wild or sexually diverse in mainstream pornography, like I said, are really a few narrow tropes repeated over and over. And what would it look like if we really got to had, you know, less censorship and more discussion about freely chosen sexuality, which is incredibly sex positive.
And just so everyone knows, we will be putting a copy of the this fabulous text chat on the website afterwards, so people can be able to see what the conversation is, because it's flying by quickly, and it's here it's very hard. Someone points out that even, I assume they've been, Victoria's Secret's television is pretty much as good as watching porn, as the person, as Suzanne's son-in-law says. And it's interesting, porn has messages, and Wendy talks about messages not just for young men, but also messages for young women. Well, great. I think this is a really great piece, and thank you, Shira, for sharing. What we're going to do is we're going to probably skip this next section it talked about doing, and we're going to move on to Byron. So, and then Shira's going to come back, and we're going to have a discussion with all of us together. So thank you, Shira. So Byron, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I mean, this is a really, really thought-provoking conversation, both listening to Shira and her excerpts and watching many of the comments that are flying by in the chat room.
Right. Well, it's really important because these issues are so important for us as we think about our prevention work. You had the opportunity to write a chapter in the book that Shira edited called Men Speak Out, Views on Gender, Sex, and Power. And so can you talk a little bit about the piece that you're going to read from?
Well, the piece that I'm going to read.
How you did that, and then we'll do a text chat and then have you do some reading.
Well, the piece that I'm going to read is called Daytona Beach, Beyond Beats and Rhymes. And the essay takes the reader down to Daytona Beach, Florida, at an event called BET's Spring Bling, which is an annual event that is televised on Black Entertainment Television, or BET, every year. I'm not sure if it still airs on TV every year, but it was once a very popular show. And I kind of take the reader behind the scenes and discuss something that the viewers of BET never get a chance to see during the actual show, and that was the high level of sexual assault that took place down on Daytona Beach, the strip at Daytona Beach. And so that's what my essay basically talks about. And it also talks about what kind of went on inside of my head as the filmmaker, someone who was trying to document this event, but also someone who had been trained in gender violence prevention, and, you know, how I had to sort of navigate the whole entire situation down in Daytona, you know, using, you know, wearing both of those hats. So it's a very interesting piece. And I wrote the piece on the train as I was traveling from, I think, D.C. to New York. And you know, Shira initially asked me to write the essay, and, you know, I wasn't sure exactly, you know, how I was going to put it together, but once I started writing and recalling my experiences down at Daytona, it actually turned out to be a very easy piece to write.
Well, great. Well, thank you much. We're gonna start, before Byron reads, with a little text chat, just to think about hip-hop and how it influences your work. So let's get a sense of, we're shifting a little bit, but let's think about hip-hop, and how does it influence the work that each of you in the audience do, and how it influences you or your work? So I know I kind of surprise my son when I say I'm old school because I was listening, first started listening to Grandmaster Flash when really listening to sort of the description of issues within New York. And let's see what people say, what they're saying about hip-hop. Speak out against oppression and makes political statements. Have a love-hate relationship to it, especially with the misogynist lyrics. And I think we're getting a lot of themes about the misogyny and talking dirty and promoting violence and some of the complications. So, and so there's sort of a tension, the love-hate, and that's coming up a lot, where I think people really appreciate it and also are really concerned around some of the images. I love Jessica's comment that, let's note that country and rock also have those offenders, and I even point out opera does too. But hip-hop is often demonized, and so we want to think about it. But it's also a way to be able to talk about issues, and that's where I think and it's also a lot of creativity. So interesting, Byron, seeing all these comments about how our audience impressions and how the role that hip hop plays in our audience's lives.
Absolutely, and I'm reading them as they stream by, and it's very similar to the reaction to my film Hip Hop Beyond Beats and Rhymes, where people have very strong opinions about their relationship to hip hop, the effect of hip hop, and also putting hip-hop into its proper social and political and historical context in terms of masculinity as well.
Yeah, well, there's lots of very interesting things. It's interesting seeing, someone, Shira's making a comment about Too Short, and it's interesting, living in the Oakland area, he's actually doing a lot of really fabulous, Todd Shaw is actually doing a lot of great violence prevention work, too. So, interesting set of tensions. Well, Byron, why don't you read from your chapter, and then we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about it afterwards.
Okay, so I'm going to read an excerpt that begins on page 19 of the essay, of the book, I'm sorry. And prior to where I began, I sort of set up the whole entire scene in a very vivid way, just sort of, elaborately sort of detailing the environment, the scene, the locale, what people are wearing, up until the point just before dusk, after things start to get very interesting. I'll just put it at that. So, I'll begin here. A BET performance lets out, and now there are thousands of hip-hop fans on the strip. It is hot, very hot. Men drape their shoulders with white hand towels and occasionally wipe away their sweat. Some let their towels hang long from their back pockets, a hip-hop fashion statement. They all swagger. I quickly realized that this is not just black space. This is black male space. The masculine energy is palpable. Women in small groups stick close together as they walk to their next destination. Suddenly, as if a tacit agreement among the men had been reached, the men begin to make life difficult for the women. As women in skimpy bathing suits exit the beach area to cross the crowded Daytona Strip, men with video cameras follow. One unfortunate threesome, one white, one black, and one Latina, get stuck at a crosswalk and wait for their turn to cross the street. The men with video cameras descend. A man with an audacious gumption lifts the white woman's blue and white sundress and records her bare ass. As he tilts his camera upward, she swipes at his hands and spins. Simultaneously, the light turns red, as if to save her from further distress. She begins to cross the street. Her two friends try to prevent themselves from being recorded, but to no avail. The men capture their bodies on camera without their approval. Who knows where these women's likenesses will end up? On the same sidewalk, about 20 yards ahead, a man in a red, white, and blue T-shirt hustles homemade DVDs from last year's Spring Bling, titled Dirty South. An image of a black woman's behind graces the cover. You do not see her face, just her buttocks and legs. I tell my cameraman to get a shot of him. Realizing he is on camera, he hams it up. Holding one DVD close to the lens, he endorses his product like a hip-hop Donald Trump. He knows his target audience, young, male, with hip-hop sensibilities. He looks directly into the camera when he speaks, and then to me when he is done. He has no clue I am an anti-sexist activist. No one here does. I blend right in with the crowd because I am a man. Not even my Angela Davis t-shirt gives me away. I head up the street with my crew behind me. I tell Bill to stay close to me as we move through the thick crowd. The men form lines on both sides of the sidewalk as the women walk through the center. It is clearly a setup. One by one, as women with various shapes, skin complexions, and hairstyles walk through, the men, showing no restraint, grab at body parts. Arms, shoulders, hands, chests, and asses. Nothing is off limits. Some women yell, "Stop, quit, and get off of me." Others helplessly ask, "What are you doing?" Most remain silent. One out of maybe every 10 of the women swings violently at a male offender. They are the courageous ones. Resistors this brave are rare. The others seem to endure it. Then, out of nowhere, I hear a roar. I turn around and see a young man, probably in his mid-20s, pulling down a heavy-set woman's bikini top. She stands there, smiling. She is complicit, but doesn't seem well. She looks mentally challenged. I watch as he and his boy stand around the woman, smiling, pointing at her bare breasts. Video cameras, including mine, roll. As an anti-sexist activist, my first instinct is to intervene, but I remember I am here to document this event, not to be a proactive bystander. My inaction fills my body with inner conflict. I feel tense, uncomfortable, nervous. I am vexed at what I see, but I remain focused on capturing the moment on film for the greater good of revealing the prevalence of misogyny in hip-hop culture and how normalized it has become. No one challenges the two men at all. In fact, men cheer from the sidelines, rewarding the duo's sexual violence. In an instant, I muster the courage to approach the two men. I walk closer to the scene. Bill and Caleb are in tow. "What makes you feel like it's okay to pull this woman's top off like this in public?" I ask. The one caught in the act sheepishly grins, revealing braces on his teeth. He tries to be coy. "Nah, see, what happened was, I was walking past her, right? And she grabbed my ass, so I grabbed her tits," he says. I look at him straight in the eye as if to say, "Yeah, right, man, don't try and play me." I repeat my question. His husky friend, apparently his road dog for the weekend, jumps in. He begins to break down the situation on behalf of all black men in America. "Look here," he says. "The white boys got their girls going wild. Now this is our girls going wild, you see? Why should the white boys have all the fun? They have their MTV spring break. Now this is our spring break. The white boys do it. Why can't we? We're not trying to hurt no one. We're just trying to have a good time." Unmoved, I reframe my question. "What if someone did something like that to your daughter or your sister?" He becomes defensive. "Aw, man, why are you trying to play me out like that, brother?" Then he motions to Bill to turn the camera off. I give Bill a quick, sharp look, nonverbal communication for, "Don't you even think about turning off that camera." The guy, realizing now that I was dead serious about challenging their behavior, tries to shift the conversation and questions my racial loyalty. "Yo, man, how you gonna play a black man out like that, man? Don't make us look bad on camera like that." Then he says, "Look, we're brothers, right? Why would you play us out like the white man? The white man plays us out like we're bad people. Don't be like the white man." Admittedly, this taps into my concern about revealing negative black male behavior to a largely white PBS audience. I am fearful about reinforcing stereotypes of black men as oversexed to an audience of unsophisticated, conservative white people. I almost retreat. But just before I do, I come up with a comeback line that I think might work. "But she's a black woman, though," I say. "How can I be against the race if I'm supporting a black woman? It's not like she's white or green or an alien," I say, growing more confident in my position. "This is a black woman that you're disrespecting, and you're challenging my blackness?" Stumped, he tries to deflect by pointing at my shirt. "Who is this?" he asks, looking down at the iconic photo of the Afro-wearing woman on my chest. "She's a Black Panther, right?" "Yeah," I say. "This is Angela Davis." "My daddy was a Black Panther," he says. "I got mad respect for the Panthers." Well, not only was she a Black Panther, I tell him, but she's also a Black feminist. Oh, word, he says. He seems to lose interest. Word, I say. And she would never approve of you treating a Black woman this way. Moving closer to me as if to share a well-kept secret, he says, dog, I know it's wrong, but if the women let us treat them this way, then we're going to treat them this way. You know what I'm saying? It's just how it is. I smell alcohol on his breath and realize this conversation is only going to go so far. I tell him it doesn't matter if women allow us to mistreat them. It's still not cool. Just as I was making my point, a tricked-out car passes by which catches everyone's attention. Suddenly, the interview is over. I looked away for a second, and the two men were gone. At dusk, the scene at Daytona worsens. The men here are completely out of control. Check that. The men here are completely in control. They are benefiting from the type of male privilege that transcends race. Even the police officers, who are white, remain silent. If the women were white, I wonder if they would be so nonchalant about enforcing the law. The women, save but a few outspoken voices, are too complacent, too accepting of sexist behavior without resistance. My crew and I grow tired of shooting scene after scene of sexual assaults and take a break. We find a place on the strip that is not as crowded and sit down on the curb. My sound man, Caleb, asks if we can go home. I knew it was going to be wild down here, but I didn't expect this, he says. Stunned by the enormity of the situation, I sit with my head cradled in my hands. My young production assistant, Malik, seems less disturbed than the rest of us. I'm going to get some pizza. Do y'all want something? He asks. There is a long silence. No one answers. Then Bill, who is white, says softly, as if he's unsure it's cool to say aloud, this is exactly what white people think about Black people. You know that, right, Byron? I sigh. His question is genuine, honest, and perfectly timed. I'm thinking the same thing, but I don't want to admit it to Bill. To outsiders, we look really bad, to people who don't understand our complex history and culture. Shit, we look bad, period, no matter the spectator. There's no comeback for Bill's sad but true admission. I feel disappointed in my people, both male and female. I sit thinking about my work as an anti-sexist activist, a man who speaks to groups of men about rape and sexual assault, and how much work there is to be done before this kind of male behavior becomes socially unacceptable. I think about women who, just like men, internalize sexism and how so many participate in their own degradation. I feel sad and overwhelmed. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you, Byron. There's been lots of conversation and some interesting questions. One theme that I've noticed has been a question that's been, I'm trying now to, the role, we look at the role from, Stephanie made some comment earlier, you wrote about women participating in their own degradation, and there's concern around the victim blaming element. And talk about how you try to approach that in the work you do.
Well, I have to admit that down at that particular scene, there did appear to be a number of women who did seem to be validated by this kind of negative attention that they were receiving by men. And I wanted to be honest about that and be real about that. I work very hard not to get involved in any sort of victim blaming at all. Instead, I try to focus as much as possible on male behavior and what leads us to think and behave the way that we do, especially in a public place like the one that I just talked about down at Daytona at an event like this. So I did mention in my essay that there were women who resisted, who actually stood up for themselves and spoke out about the way that the men were treating them. But there were also a lot of women there who did sort of, go along to get along. And I understand that that's very complex and there are reasons for that. But in painting the picture for this particular essay, I wanted to be honest about what my eyes saw down at the scene. And I think that that's what made it even more overwhelming for me. especially as someone who has been engaging in gender violence prevention work for so many years, especially talking to boys and men. It's always very, very difficult for me as a gender violence prevention educator speaking and working with men, because men always tend to deflect and always tend to deny that there's a real problem and always tend to blame the women for their situation or for their circumstances. And what I always try and do is kind of flip it and, you know, get men to look at our own attitudes and our own behavior. But in this particular scene, I felt like I had to be honest about what was actually taking place down there. And I think that that's tragic because, you know, while there were women who were buying into their own degradation and who were complicit, that's not the conversation that I want to have. The conversation I really want to have is what makes it socially acceptable for so many boys and men to think that this is okay, to treat women this way in both private and public spaces.
Well, thank you. I mean, this is so, and I'm so busy reading the text chats, as I'm sure everyone else is, about the complicated nature of this. Let's move to a text chat question to think about, once again, to revisit this theme a little bit more. About what have we learned about masculinity from hip-hop and how the role that masculinity plays? So let's take a couple minutes and write in about this. And I know, what have you learned about masculinity from hip-hop, and what do you see that hip-hop teaches about masculinity? And Ashley jumps in with money, and that money becomes a theme, and that's certainly explored in the display of money you talk about in Beyond Beats and Rhymes. I think a lot of this, and Tara raised a good point, it depends on what type of hip-hop you're listening to, and that there's a lot of different types of hip-hop, and I think that's an important piece as we move to looking about, well, we can do a change. As we talk about some of the change, we can also look at how hip-hop can be used to promote a positive masculinity and to empower women. And there was a Tribe Called Quest quote, which I'm now, hip-hop can never be a, oh, it's moving by so quickly, I can't read it.
Yeah, no, it's, but again, I mean, this just shows you just how powerful, you know, these issues are, especially around hip-hop, and people have so many thoughts and feelings around it, and this is what, this is kind of what a typical, screening for me looks like, you know, during the question and answer session. You know, people always have lots to say. And, you know, one of the things that I've noticed is how quickly we all tend to focus in on hip-hop without sort of putting hip-hop in a larger social context. And I think, you know, since the time that I made my film, Beyond Beats and Rhymes, you know, I'm starting to really tire of, you know, exclusively focusing on hip-hop. And I know that you mentioned earlier that misogyny and violence extends way beyond hip-hop music as a genre. But I think when we pay so much attention to hip-hop, as many of the people in the chat probably already know, then we really give other really deeply problematic hyper-masculine genres of music, but also just institutions within our culture a really huge pass. And, you know, what amazes me is how popular things like Ultimate Fighting and how mainstream Ultimate Fighting is becoming in the culture and how those images and representations, you know, reinforce the very same kind of hyper-masculine aggression that rap music does. And so I think that we have to look at, you know, all of the places and spaces where we see this exaggerated sense of masculinity and, like, to really question it and challenge it and to raise questions about, you know, what makes it so popular and what that reveals about our culture of masculinity.
And I noticed several people in the text chat pointing out the example of, you know, something that seemingly benign as Disney, but yet is reinforcing perhaps even more insidiously these same issues that we're talking about. And there's also a discussion about some positive examples within hip-hop for black women in true masculinity. And can you talk a little bit about that, about what you see the potential is for hip-hop to be mechanism for change that's going to be really positive.
Well, unfortunately, I think that the brand of hip-hop that is the most socially progressive, where there's not as much misogyny, there's not as much hyper-aggression, or there's not as much crass materialism and commercialization of, or I would say excess, is very much marginalized in the culture. I mean, it's not mainstream. And you have to be very familiar with artists like Talib Kweli, Lupe Fiasco, or, you know, other artists, Mos Def and other artists that, you know, people tend to, you know, gravitate toward who are into positive, progressive hip-hop, MF Doom and other artists. And I was just in Portland, Oregon at a conference. Were you at your conference in Portland, Oregon?
It was not my conference, but we were there together, yes.
We were there together. We were all there. And, you know, I met a group of really socially conscious hip-hop artists that were on a panel that I moderated, and they gave me their work, and I listened to some of it, and, you know, it's very different than what you would hear on mainstream radio. And it's just sad to me that a lot of these artists don't necessarily get the kind of recognition or publicity that they should receive. But, you know, that just means that, you know, if you're really into hip hop, you have to seek these artists out, and you have to do a little work and you have to do some digging. But, you know, I think popular culture in general is not the place to find really progressive representations of men and women in general. So we all have to go a little further and dig deep and find our space that makes us feel inspired and that you know, gives voice to some of our issues and concerns and speaks to our politics.
Thank you so much. And what I want to do is now shift this conversation a little bit to think about our role as those who are, because we're primarily in this audience, people who are doing domestic violence and sexual assault prevention work. And what we want to do is think about the role that we can play. And so I'd like to hear from the audience as the themes that we've been talking about today. Let's talk about this as practice and our prevention practice. And how do you address these issues, the issues of masculinity, sex, sexism, porn, hip-hop, in your prevention work? And let's get a sense of where we can be able to move forward, because in some ways, that's where we need to be able to move forward. And Barbara says, where do we start? And Roxanne jumps in by including men in the conversation. But I think it's to really that I know a lot of the people in the audience here, and there's a lot of doing great work. So let's look at some of these ideas and open this up for Byron and Shira, both of you, to look at some of these and see what we can be able to do. I see a lot about bystander intervention, how to be able to find a way to intervene, to be able to do that, and a lot of working with youth and advocating so for lead by example. I think a lot of example and trying to find ways and starting young. I see a lot about working with boys, and I see a lot with Katina talks about teaching girls around self-esteem, and a lot of peer work, working with peers. So, Byron or Shira, can you talk a little bit about what you see as important, any impressions around the messages of what are the steps that we can take to be able to address these issues in our prevention work?
I'll jump in with this. I'm trying to keep up with the text conversations, and it's really going fast. One of the things that I'm seeing come up that maybe we could talk about is how we can I know you want us to get really specific and concrete in applications, but I think without denigrating gender performance, how can we take away the penalty of it? So I was just in the middle of replying to somebody about, you know, tough masculinity or strong masculinity, and that doesn't mean that that's bad or wrong, but how do we reduce the penalty of it, or how do we reduce the idea that strong manhood equals violent manhood and decouple those ideas? And how do we do that if we're getting federal funding that might limit how much we can talk about in those things? I know that's kind of vague. I'm sort of trying to speak and keep up with the online conversation at the same time. I'm kind of interested in hearing from the people who are practitioners in the field, too, how what they suggest or how they see that playing
out. Someone wants to join the conversation by having a question for Byron or Shira or be able to make comments on this, go ahead and raise your hand. I think we had one question that was posed to Byron, which actually was sort of related, about would you be able, if you're going to be doing an update to Beyond Beats and Rhymes, or if you're able to partner with, you know, she was asking, were you able to partner with an influencing hip-hop artist during the documentary that can stand up on misogyny or address it openly? Because she really loves your video. Mm-hmm. So have you thought about doing a next chapter, or are you moving on to Soul Food?
Well, I'm moving on to Soul Food, but that doesn't mean that I'm not going to be addressing issues around masculinity and, you know, representations of gender in my work as a filmmaker. What I would really love to do is I would really love to make or create a 5-part series on masculinity in general. You know, just kind of weighing in on just the, you know, just the whole construction of masculinity in American culture. I mean, that would be, I would think, a dream series for me to create. But at this particular time, I do not have any plans on creating a Beyond Beats and Rhymes Part 2 or, you know, creating an extension of the film. But I do think that, you know, given some time, I believe that somebody else is going to pick up where I left off with those issues and explore it through film.
Great. So if someone wants to be able to join our conversation, just raise your hand in the meeting and we can unmute your phone and be able to have you join the conversation and be able to ask a question of Byron or Shira. So if anyone, or you can write that in to the question. Sorry, there's so many questions that have been going on and it flies by quickly. So go ahead and raise your hand if you want to be able to have a question. And yes, Byron does travel and speaks at events. I do see that. We do have the information for contacting both Byron and Shira on the website, so you can get on the slides on Prevent Connect, so you can be able to get information on how to be able to contact both Byron and Shira. So S. Robin has raised your hand. If you can press *1 on your phone, S. Robin, and then that will be able to unmute your phone and you can join the conversation. And, operator, do we have a line?
Yes, I'll open that line right now.
Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Shani.
Hi, Shani. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to say thank you so much for doing this. This was amazing and well needed. I'm out in central Pennsylvania. I'm an advocate for sexual assault and domestic violence legal advocate. And I'm also a community organizer for the National Organization for Women, and I'm a woman of color. So these are issues that I'm always trying to get people on board for. And my question is actually for Byron. Byron, are you there?
I am here.
Byron, we show your documentary, Behind Beats and Rhymes, all the time. Yeah, I mean, you definitely are part of our movement here, and your work is very important to us. And I just wanted to say, well, actually I wanted to ask you if you would be willing to travel for an event. And I know I can contact you, but I really wanted to verbally talk to you because we're thinking it's going to be a huge event and it's going to target people of color, the LGBT community, the Latino community, Hispanic community, and it's going to be huge. And we're using poets, hip-hop artists, singers, dancers to kind of talk about the issue of sexual violence.
Where are you located again?
I'm in the Penn State Hub, State College, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And it's going to be held right at Penn State University, though.
Okay. Well, you can just send me, if you can, just send me a private message at email message at byronhurt@behurt.com.
Byronhurt@behurt.com?
@behurt.com.
Okay. All right. I will contact you.
Okay.
Just to note, Byron just put his Facebook address, and that's another good way to be able to get word and see what's going on with the work that Byron's doing. So in our age of social media, this is great. Both of our speakers both also tweet. So, and I know I've seen several people during this web conference too. Great. Brian Reed, you had a question. Would you be willing to press star 1 to unmute your phone and you can ask the question of the audience? You send it as a private chat, but it would be great to pose the question to us so everyone can hear. So press star 1. And operator, do you have a phone line?
Yes, just a moment, please.
David.
Yes.
Hey, it's Brian. This question is for either Shira or Byron. And I'm a student of critical race theory as well, and my question is the reclamation of masculinity possible provided the sort of the historical and social negativity related to it? And like some critical race theory, should we instead focus on the abolition of masculinity?
Okay, who wants to jump right there? Shira, first.
I'll jump in. I do not advocate getting rid of gender. That's not part of my argument. Part of what I would like to see is that we are each more free to be gendery as we see fit without a penalty. And whether that means women being high femmes, whether that means men being, you know, quote unquote, those stereotypes of masculinity, but to be free to express those things without the penalties, you know, so a femininity would not be disrespected, or that person wouldn't be thought of as stupid or only sexually available, and it's not all only attached to the embodied woman's body. And so I don't see eradicating gender or masculinity as the answer, but providing more options for being more gendery in our expressions of our personal selves. That's where I'm at with that.
Great. Byron, do you want to add anything?
Can that question be rephrased? I was trying to respond to a question in the chat, Jessica's question in the chat, actually. But can you restate the question?
Yes, am I still active?
Yes, you are, Brian.
Oh, great. Yeah, Brian, my question was that provided all the negativity historically, politically, and socially surrounding masculinity, is it possible to reclaim masculinity in more positive ways, or like some critical race theorists, should we be more focused on the abolition of masculinity?
Hmm.
I don't have a leaning one way or the other. I'm really, this is genuine curiosity.
Yeah, well, the abolition of masculinity, I think the abolition of the construction of masculinity might not be such a bad thing. I just don't know how you avoid it. You know, I mean, it's such a huge part of boys and men's training. You know, I'm not sure that you can completely eliminate it. You know, I do think that we just have to, all men have to present themselves in a way that really does express the full range of masculinity, you know, to embrace all aspects of our humanity and not just the characteristics that have been deemed manly, you know, by the culture. And I think that that's what we have to actively do, and, you know, myself included. And, you know, I think that it's very, very important that, you know, more men show, especially men in positions of leadership and authority and power and all those different things, demonstrate to other men, you know, what really secure masculinity, you know, looks like. And I think, you know, one of the people who does it pretty well, I would say very well, with some exceptions, I think is Barack Obama, you know, the President of the United States. I think that, you know, from what I can see, he does a pretty good job of displaying that full range of manhood and masculinity, although I do have to say personally that I'm a little disappointed about the troop surge in Afghanistan, but that's a personal political, you know, comment that I'm throwing in there as well. You know, the fact that he talks about co-partnering with his wife and being a father to his daughters, and we see him taking his daughters to school and seemingly being concerned about, you know, the health and welfare of girls and women in our country, and you know, for him to speak with confidence about that, I think is really, really important. And I think that, you know, more men have to see these kinds of representations of manhood so that we have the space to do it. And, you know, I just growing up in male culture, I know firsthand just how intense the culture of masculinity is. I don't know if you can abolish it altogether, but I think that we just have to make it cool for guys to be secure in who they are. And I think that that's what I would like to see happen.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And it's great looking in the text chat here. There's now a discussion about a Facebook page. You can all join Prevent Connect and use that as your Facebook page to be able to do some of this. Michelle D'Souza has raised her hand. If you can press *1, that would be great. It's also great looking in the text chat, seeing that someone made a connection from Penn State with the person who first raised our question. So it looks like we were helping get networking going. That's great. So do we have a line unmuted, operator?
Yes, we're opening that line now.
Thank you very much.
Hello, this is Samantha.
Oh, hi, Samantha.
I'm with Michelle.
Oh, okay. Hi, Samantha, who appears as Michelle, but she is Samantha, yes.
Yes, we're all together. I work in higher education, and there's a shortage of men of color. And when I look at the work that I do with the intersections around race and gender, knowing that having students have a representation of themselves within the faculty and the administration where there's a shortage, what are some suggestions that, Byron, that you have for myself and for other women of color and allies to make a difference in the lives of the students that we work with around this issue?
Can you restate the first part of your question?
Yeah, there's a shortage of men of color that work in education, whether it's K through 12 or higher education. And part of the work that I do looks at the intersections of race and gender. And so as a woman of color doing this work, I'd like to know if you have some advice for those of us and our allies in working with Black, Latino, Native American, Asian men and looking at and deconstructing what masculinity means, especially around violence.
Wow. Well, I mean, that's a problem and an issue that's, I'm afraid, much larger than I can really address in this one phone conversation. But, you know, I think that, again, you have to just find a way to engage them without making them feel defensive or feel like they're being attacked. And I know that that's a very difficult thing to do, especially when there is an absence of men of color who could sort of play the role of the teacher or the facilitator or the person who is engaged in the conversation. I think, just off the top of my head as I'm thinking through it, I think that media is a very good way to do it, to engage, you know, boys and men, and to really ask some really, you know, challenging questions about the kind of media that they are watching. And to get them to think critically about, you know, what it is that they're engaged in. I think that's really important. So media literacy, I think, would have to be, I hate to say, use the word stand-in, but, you know, media literacy would have to be to serve as a tool to kind of say things that you may not be able to say as a woman and a woman of color, you know, to reach the boys and men who you're talking to. I mean, I'm not presenting that as the solution. I'm saying that that could be, you know, one particular strategy in engaging boys and men. The other thing is, you know, to increase your efforts to recruit as many, you know, men of color as possible to come in, to be guest speakers, to come in and give presentations or, to somehow, you know, reach the boys that you're working with. Outside of that, you know, I really don't have any answer in terms of how to structurally, you know, create, you know, make room for more men, you know, in education. I mean, that's a little bit outside of my realm of expertise.
But it, once again, I think speaks really articulately to what we've been talking about the whole time, is that we really have to look at the intersection and that we can't really address the issues of violence against women and the issues of masculinity separate from these other issues because they really overlap with each other and influence each other.
Absolutely. That's
okay,
true.
I see that Barbara Sire Roman has raised her hand. If you can press *1, Barbara, and then we can unmute your phone. To press *1. And Barbara, do we have a phone line open?
Yes, just a moment, please.
Thank you.
Hello?
Hi, Barbara.
This is actually Judy Rosenstein. I'm with Barb.
Okay, we have this. You're great, so welcome, Judy.
Thank you. So we're really, really interested in Zara's question about how, as women, we can not appear as raging feminists to our male students in particular.
Okay, well, I've seen this on the text chat. Who wants to, Shira, do you want to start?
Yeah, I can start, and I think I commented that this is, you know, such an important conversation that I would love to continue having. You know, when I teach, one of the first strategies that I use is to say, you know, let's just get the stereotypes out there about feminists. You know, let's just get them up on the board. And my students are at first kind of shocked that I'm willing to, like, if they're slow on the, you know, to take it up, I'm like, okay, how about bra burner, angry, dyke, hairy legged, you know, and then they sort of join in, and it's like, okay, let's get it all off our chest, you know, and then we start talking about the issues. And so sometimes just even freeing up that space to say, you can say, this is space where you can say what you want to say, and if you've got stereotypes you need to get off your chest or that you believe, let's have at it. Some people are going to feel defensive regardless, and that's when I need to let them know that I don't take these issues personally. This is not about me. But I'm willing, once I'm willing to be up in front of that group of people talking, you know, let's have the conversation. And sometimes I use strategies where I pose more questions than I feed information. So it requires that the people in the room, you know, in a classroom or whatever the setting is, think through it and take the responsibility for thinking through the issues on their own so that I'm not talking at them, but that we're having more dialogue. And so I don't know, like, what setting you're working in. What setting are you working in?
Judy, what?
We're
the Navy, right?
We're the Naval Academy, so
Naval
it's
Academy.
College and future military officers.
Oh, wow.
It's a challenging group.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've done a lot of... Sorry, sir. I don't mean to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
You know, I've worked in the Marine Corps. I think I've done some work with... I've done work with the Air Force. I'm not sure if I've done any work with the Navy, but I think I've done work in military culture where men from the Navy were present and women from the Navy were present. And I think I think I agree with Shira. I mean, I think that you're going to get resistance no matter what. I mean, even if you're a man addressing these issues, you're going to be getting resistance from men who don't want to talk about these issues. And I think the way to really to get around it is to just go right at it. You know, is to address it head on and to be as honest and candid as humanly possible. And you know, I find that analogies always work well. I also find that when you try and position these issues so that they appear to be serving in men's best interests, you know, not in a way to kind of pander to men, but to just show and reveal how dealing with sexual violence and physical violence actually helps men. It doesn't hurt men. I think that works really well. But, you know, because I'm a man, it's really, really difficult for me as a man to say, well, you know, tell you as a woman what you have to do to not appear feminist. I mean, it's like me as an African-American man, you know, speaking out against racism, right? It's like, how do I talk about racism without, you know, my white audience being turned off or intimidated or feeling like, you know, I'm a militant black man, an angry black man, right? So there's a way that you have to sort of, you know, think about what you're going to say, how you're going to say it, and sort of address the issue in a way that's going to be honest and candid, but you're also, you know, letting people know in the room that, you know, you're not there to condemn them. You're not there to make them feel bad about themselves mm-hmm. as people. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You're there to provide information. You're there to pull and reveal and get them, as Cheryl was talking about, get them to think critically about whatever issue you're addressing, and to get them to be, you know, critical about sexism, you know, and violence against women. So I appreciate how difficult it must be, because I know when I was working in the Marine Corps, it was even difficult for me as a man to address these issues. So I really, really respect and appreciate, you know, the struggle that you must have, you know, addressing these issues within that particular culture.
Yeah, I just think that instead, it might be easier to reframe this, take it away from the raging feminists and just put it in the issue of legitimacy.
And, you know, I have to say, and like what Byron said, you know, not to pander to the men in the room, but to really acknowledge that that's where, you know, for me, to acknowledge that sometimes they can't hear my voice, literally cannot hear my voice as a female voice in the way that they can hear a man's voice. So sometimes I'll have on hand resources that lead them to other men who are speaking, you know, whether it's Byron or Jackson Katz or the magazine Voicemail, or, you know, to bring in those voices where then they can become aware of other men who are on board with this. They can hear a variety of voices, literally and sort of, you know, symbolically. And it is partly in the presentation of myself, you know, in saying, let's be really honest about these. This is hard stuff to talk about, and this isn't about any of us personally. But, you know, once... And I think it's much like racism, when we talk about sexism, one of the things that I just put right out there, you know, probably most of us would come to the room and say, oh, sexism, that's really a terrible thing, or, oh, racism, that's really a terrible thing. But then when we start talking about men's accountability or white people's accountability, that's when I see white people or men start to bristle and get defensive. And so I'll just put that out there from the beginning. And I don't, and I, in my demeanor, I don't do it as a finger pointing or as an accusation, but like, huh, isn't this curious? Well, let's just call it out for what it is and then let's move on. And so like Byron was saying, various strategies in managing that, but I feel for you too. I'm so glad you're doing that work though. I'm really glad.
Thank you very much. That was a great question, and there's so much more that can be said about how we can do this, but we are unfortunately at that time ending. So I want to really thank today Shira and Byron. Here is their contact information, just so you are able to visit their websites. There's been a lot of interest, so on the Prevent Connect Facebook page, we've got a discussion board, so you can continue the discussion. Twitter is another way, in 140 characters less, that we can continue the discussion. I see it looks like Ashley and who is the other, Nancy, I think, have been tweeting away today. So that's been really during the web conference, so I'm very impressed. It. Google Wave, I'm actually going to be, I just joined, so I'm actually going to be looking at Google Wave of how we might do this in the future. So thank you, Shira, and thank you, Byron, for joining what was a wonderful conversation for us to explore these issues. And we will continue this discussion because in order to really prevent domestic violence and sexual violence, it takes us really thinking deeply and working with each other. So thank you, Shira. Thank you, Byron. Thank you, Chad, for all the work in the background who really made this happen. And thank you all for participating. We will have a copy of all the text chat. We'll take some people's names, identifying names out, but we'll put that up. We'll also have you'll be getting it about now, an email from me asking you to fill out an evaluation. Please do that. That really helps what we do. So thanks a lot, and we will see you all online in the future. And we've got a podcast coming out with Byron also, actually, from the conference in Oregon, and we'll have more materials. So this will conclude our audio portion of the conference. I'll keep the text chat open for a few more minutes, so if you want to write things down, you can do that. And thank you all, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you. Bye. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
And that does conclude our conference. Thank you for your participation.